And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Race IndyCar podcast. Feels like a while since we've recorded, and there's been it's kind of simultaneously been a lot going on and not much going on in the world of IndyCar at the moment, but I'm alongside JL Hildebrand, who I'm assuming is you're still licking your wounds from the Super Bowl fiasco, which was unfortunate for you. But yeah, how do you feel about that whole thing? Did you go in with low expectations, so you weren't that bothered afterwards, or was it kind of like you kind of got your hopes up a little bit and thought it might be possible?
I definitely felt it was doable.
Yeah, me too. I actually thought 49ers might win it, but yeah.
I felt like it was tough. I mean, it was obviously a good matchup in terms of just like relative in different ways, but evenly competitive teams, you know, right to the end. So just a bummer. I was talking, there's a meme in 49er country that's I don't remember what the mascot's name is, but like, you know, the gold 49ers guy, like, you know, like kind of looking up at the Golden Gate Bridge, and there's a rainbow over his head and it just says, "I want to die." And I feel like that was just very much like that circulated a lot on Sunday evening, because it really is like, would you rather get to the Super Bowl and lose? And this has happened for the Niners, like,
yeah, a lot of times,
you know, three times in kind of relatively recent memory, yeah, or just be like kind of mediocre. I don't know. I'm not really sure which one's better or worse, but yeah, a bummer for sure.
You've still got Steph Curry making some amazing shots for the Golden State Warriors, so that can at least appease you for
now. But then you've also got like, are we just totally wasting?
Yep. You are
like the greatness of Steph Curry right now too. Like, I'm not sure that that's actually making it any better.
No, in isolation of watching purely Steph Curry play, it's a positive.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how you have to look at it. Anyway, enough other sports talk, because we have IndyCar going on at the moment. There's a few little things bubbling under the surface, I guess. We're still waiting for Dale Coyne to confirm both their drivers at the point of recording, which is the 13th of February. We also wish our best to David Malukas, who's having some hand surgery after a mountain bike accident. We don't want to speculate too much about what that means for the future until his surgery and what might happen there. We'll have to keep our eyes on that one as that story kind of develops. In the meantime, JR, we've got a very exciting episode coming up for people to listen to with Angela Ashmore. So anytime you get a chance to have a Ganassi engineer on the show is always a lovely opportunity to fire some cool engineering-related questions. Angela also, according to IndyCar, is the fourth lead female engineer in IndyCar history as well. So we're going to head over to Angela, have a chat with her about her kind of how she got into motorsport at first, and also how she's ended up in her current role at Ganassi, but also a little bit about women in motorsport and the kind of the feeling she's got from IndyCar as well. So I don't mind saying, because it's not anything to do with me, but it's an absolutely fantastic interview. Angela's really candid and really, really brilliant on everything that she's kind of been through and what's coming up for her as well this season. So without further ado, we'll head over and speak to Angela now. All right, Angela Ashmore, thank you for joining us on the Race IndyCar podcast. Really nice to have you here. And you've got a big new role this year looking after Marcus Armstrong. And knowing Marcus quite well, you're going to have your work cut out. He's a bundle of fun to work with. So you're going to have a lot of fun there. Yeah, like I said, thanks for joining us. And I guess just wanted to get a little bit into your background to start with and find out a little bit more about you and how you ended up in IndyCar. I guess I've read before that I think your dad and an uncle competed when you were younger and you were able to kind of watch them compete. But when did you kind of identify motorsport or something that you wanted to get into, and also engineering as well. When did that kind of, when did that come up for you?
Yeah, thanks for having me. We'll just jump right into it. So how I got into racing, we were just fans watching on TV. My dad really enjoyed watching NASCAR. And so I was a little daddy's girl. And so I would just watch on Sundays with him. We'd watch on TV, and we had a local short track, Berlin Raceway. So we'd get to go every once in a while down to our local short track. It was a 7/16 mile, which is a very specific distance. 7/16 mile concrete track, and absolutely loved going to the racetrack. And so I knew really young that I loved racing. I wanted to make it my life. Had no idea how I was going to make that happen. I thought for sure I was going to be a race car driver. And then I got a little older and wiser. Got to be high school age and realized, I'm not a professional athlete, but I do have a good head on my shoulders, very good at math and science, analytical mind. So I was really well suited to engineering. It was a natural fit for me. So I decided kind of at that point that that was going to be my path to make motorsports a career, was to go get an engineering degree. So went to Purdue, got my master's degree in mechanical engineering, and actually didn't find a job in racing straight out of school. The motorsports industry was kind of in a bad spot when I graduated. So I went and worked at an OEM for a few years until I could find a spot to get in.
It was like 2008, roughly, like when you graduated. So it was like right around that difficult period where some of the teams were like scaling down and stuff like that. Yeah.
It was 2010 when I graduated, and it was, half the paddock was laid off. So I didn't think it was a great time to be coming in as someone with no experience.
I'm curious, just to jump in for a second. When you were, so you talked about, sort of your experience going through high school, having been around racing, having seen it a lot at the short track, like, was that sort of like super modifieds and super late models? Like what was the style of racing that you were growing up? Just cause I'm curious.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing at our track was super late models. And like once a year, they might have a special event where you get like one or two NASCAR drivers would come and drive, super modified, super late models. But the big show was always super late models. Okay. So you'd watch the four cylinders go around and stuff like that. And that Berlin has kind of grown over the years, and they actually have brought World of Outlaws, and they convert the track to dirt now once a year. So the scope of racing there has increased a lot since when I was growing up. But when I was growing up, it was just local short track guys that were racing.
Yeah, that's cool. So you grew up kind of around this, and I had maybe a little bit of a similar experience. On the West Coast, like my dad just raced as a hobby. We just went to a lot of races, whether it was Sears Point or Laguna Seca. You kind of saw this wide variety of stuff we watched on TV. I grew up admittedly a NASCAR fan too. Like I was a huge Dale Sr. fan. So
me too.
The experience that I had certainly going through high school was that just being around it, whether I was at that point I was go-karting and doing some of those things, but not at like a really advanced level, but just being around motorsport made what I was doing in the classroom seem so much more relevant. And I'm curious if you can kind of speak to any particular experience you had from that perspective.
So one of the classes that I did take in high school, we had like an intro to engineering class, and the project for that class, it was basically a class centered around a project, was an electrothon racing car. And it was a super simple car. It was just deep cell marine batteries. And we designed and built this aluminum frame out of square bar stock. Very rudimentary car. The throttle is actually a 5K potentiometer, which is a little bit sketchy, actually, when I go back and think about how we were driving this thing. But I got to drive a little bit in that, and man, I was just so interested in what an interesting project that is kind of uncommon in a high school atmosphere, especially at that point in time. It really piqued my interest. It wasn't just, learning out of a textbook or, memorize this equation. It was putting something that I was interested to good use in something else that, was practical.
I guess moving on to things a little bit more recently, you've had some great experiences with Brad Goldberg and the number eight team. I guess I'm interested how you're kind of approaching your new role now, because I guess you could take some pressure into the new role, knowing, you know, what you've been able to achieve with the number eight team and all the success you've had there and the events you've won, obviously winning the Indy 500 there and all of those fantastic things you've done. But I guess you could also look at it in a way of like, you've had the perfect preparation to step into the role. So maybe it's more of a positive thing as opposed to taking any kind of pressure into the role. How are you kind of approaching it mentally and how do you feel about the new position?
I mean, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't a little bit nervous. I'm kind of approaching it how I've approached my entire career, meticulous note-taking, just studying like crazy, going through notes in excruciating detail from the last 3 years. And I find what really calms me is feeling well-prepared. So that's what I'm trying to do right now, is just go through previous races and try and envision every scenario that might happen and feel that, you know, I have a solution prepared in my head for anything that might come up.
It was a little bit of a flavor of your job as the assistant as well. And I guess I'm kind of interested to know how well that's prepared you to take over the main job, because I guess, you know, you can speak to this, but do you feel like you've basically done all of the things that a kind of lead engineer would do and that you feel like you've had, you know, you have a good grasp on the kind of tasks that you're going to have, or there are still kind of things that are outstanding that are going to be like really new for you in terms of your kind of, not just your day to day, but on a race weekend as well?
The roles are quite different. You know, as an assistant engineer, my focus during the weekend was more about making sure the car was running, ensuring we had good quality data coming off the car, focusing more on fuel strategy during the race than overall strategy and how the race was playing out. My focus is going to shift a lot as far as what I'm looking at during a weekend. However, I would say over the past year, I've been race engineering most of the hybrid events for the hybrid program. So I've had a lot of practice, I guess, in working on the car and working with all four of our drivers and now five. So I've had good preparation, I think, over the last year timeframe of working into that new role and kind of easing in a lower pressure situations. I think some of the newer things for me are going to be, you know, calling race strategy, which I've obviously had good exposure to, and Brad is one of the best at it. So I've had a great mentor in that aspect, and so I hope that, you know, I've learned some things along the way from him. And throughout the off season, I've been going through some of the past races, and if there's a point in the race that comes up where there's a decision point or something that's not totally clear, Brad sits right next to me. So I'll often stop and ask Brad, you know, like, hey, what would you do at this point in the race? Look at, you know, here's our gap to these cars. Here's where we're going to come out if we pit, and just kind of take the opportunity while we have time to sit down and discuss. You know, you can take a moment in the race where you might have, you know, 5 or 10 seconds to make a decision, and you can take 10 minutes or 20 minutes and think about all the scenarios.
You mentioned briefly while you were talking about the hybrid program, sort of that Ganassi's going from 4 cars to 5 cars, which is sort of a big story really in the background in the off season here, mm-hmm. particularly because it seems like there are a lot of other teams that are sort of going the opposite direction, going from 4 to 3. We've seen that with Andretti. We've talked at some length on the podcast just about the sort of dynamics of those kinds of expansions and reductions. You know, obviously the main part of it that gets discussed in terms of a growing team is just making sure that the team has the bandwidth to cover their bases in that kind of situation. We hear from everybody within the paddock and from paddocks outside of IndyCar how hard it is to come by talent these days, whether that be your engineering staff or mechanics. So I'm just curious from the inside how that process has seemed like it's going, what the sort of plan was, you know, from Ganassi's point of view. We would look at it from the outside and say, well, they wouldn't do it if they didn't feel prepared to do it. So I'm curious just, you know, if you can give us a little insight into how that's been going.
Yeah, I think we're well prepared for expansion. In 2020, we added the third car, which I was hired, you know, to work on the third car, the 8 with Marcus Ericsson. And then we expanded it again to four with Jimmy Johnson, which became Marcus Erickson's ride, or excuse me, Marcus Armstrong's ride. And I think that maybe there was some skepticism even at those points that we would be competitive with a third car. And lo and behold, Marcus Erickson comes out, wins races, does really well in the third car. We add the fourth car program and same thing. I don't think, you know, people expected us to be competitive with four cars. And I think that looking at Marcus Armstrong's performance over the last year as a rookie, he did exceedingly well. That team operated very well. So I think that we've been very successful. We've approached it the right way. And I expect to see nothing less with the fifth car program because we've approached it in a similar way. And we've kind of been through that expansion process twice now in recent years. I think that we have good depth of talent within the building. So that really is an asset to us to be able to support that fifth car. As you said, you know, talent's hard to come by. It's difficult to find people with good experience that are qualified to do the very specific jobs that we need to do. I think we're very fortunate that we have a lot of those people that sit in this building that, you know, are available to fill those positions.
That's just like a little off the cuff on that. You know, I'm curious, you talk to, you know, whether it's drivers or engineers or mechanics, just the kind of idea of being able to operate in some different disciplines within motorsport is always like an interesting and exciting kind of topic. You know, we talk about it from the driver point of view a lot, like guys that want to go do the 24 hours of Daytona or want to go do Bathurst or whatever, go race something on dirt or whatever. And Chip Ganassi Racing is one of the teams that for as long as I can remember has always had, you know, other things outside of, like, if you viewed IndyCar as being maybe the core business or the core racing championship or discipline that Ganassi, you know, is consistently doing, they've always got something else, whether it be, you know, sports cars or extreme E of late, of the last, you know, couple of years. Is that, do you view that to be, I suppose it's kind of an intangible thing, but you know, just something that piques people's interest about coming to work at Chip Ganassi Racing, just that there's maybe these sort of different avenues of ways that you can scratch a different type of itch maybe here and there. I'm curious if that factored into your decision making at all. It seems like an interesting place to work from that point of view, that there's some different things going on.
You know, it was something that was interesting to me when I was making my decision in 2020, what I was going to do, just because there's kind of room to move around. If you wanted to make a lateral move or try something different, you could make that move without having to give up your whole career or, you know, to give up your seniority or, you know, to have to learn to work with a whole new group of people. If you decided that, you know, like, hey, I really just can't travel anymore, I still want to work in racing. You know, we have a good group of designers, you know, we have a group of simulation people. So there's roles that would allow you to maybe step away from traveling or step down in traveling, or like, let's say, I don't know, maybe you'd have to be crazy, but let's say you didn't want to work in IndyCar anymore. You just wanted to go try something different for a couple of years. You know, you could move laterally over the sports car program without having to move, you know, to a completely different organization. And that sort of stability for me was important. And I think it is to other people as well, that you're not going to have to pack up your whole life and try and start over somewhere new that may or may not work out. You've got continuity within one place to, you know, build your career over time.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Maybe taking it back to IndyCar more specifically, we did a tech special recently. We took a bunch of audience questions. We had another engineer, Charlie Ping, on board with us, who has a sort of a broad spectrum of, you know, of experience in a lot of different places. I'm curious, we talked a lot about, you know, dampers come up a lot in the context of IndyCar because everybody sort of knows it's this black magic that's going on behind the scenes. I'm curious, so we'll put that to the side. If there's something else that's sort of maybe an underappreciated aspect of performance in IndyCar that is not so obvious to the outside, as something that, you know, all the teams are spending a lot of time on, what would you think that would be, or a couple of things maybe?
Ooh. That's a good question.
Putting you on the spot. You have to think quickly.
Honestly, I think one of the differentiators is calling strategy. It's something that is a very specific skill and something that some people are much better than others at, and something that I'm going to strive to be better than others at. One of the things as an assistant engineer that I think has served me well was building our fuel program that we use in-house, and kind of built that scope so that it was transferable over to our INSA program. So everyone's kind of using that same fuel strategy program. I think your ability to see the scope of a race and make good quality decisions based on calculated risk is kind of what it's kind of intangible almost, because people look at the result of a race and say, like, well, that ended well, so that was a good decision, or that ended poorly, so that was a bad decision. And I think that that's a dangerous way of thinking. You have to be able to decouple your decision outcome from your decision quality. You can make a great decision based on the information you have and still have a poor outcome. So I think that's a difficult skill to have, because you really only develop it in high pressure situations, and you have, 17 chances a year to do it. So I think that's my number one, would be strategy calls.
Strategy is an interesting one, because you don't necessarily, like, if you want to be an engineer, you go to college and learn the principles of engineering, right? And you can study, and there's a lot you can do to kind of prepare yourself, even if it's not necessarily motorsport specific. You can give yourself the tools to do that job. But with IndyCar strategy, like knowing which cars to be picking up and being able to judge the gaps and just basically kind of computing so much information at once across so many different cars and keeping an eye on so many different things. It's not really something that you can necessarily just sit and learn instantly. It's
Right.
something that, I guess, it takes a long time to adapt to.
And it develops over time. And I think honestly, some people it just comes naturally to, and other people maybe never really get it.
You're in
Yeah.
the right team.
I'm curious, just because it's popped into my head. You were talking about the fuel strategy, the sort of, the system that you guys have come up with to help identify fuel strategy throughout the race. I'm curious, like, it seems we talked to a few drivers about this even, that it has seemed like tire degradation has played a much more significant role in how you think about strategy over the last couple of years in particular. And maybe that's to do with the tires. Maybe that's just a function of IndyCar getting so close. There's some new tracks that have been in the mix that, whatever. So I'm not going to take a swing at like exactly why that has been the case, but it has seemed to become more of a trend. I'm curious if that's something that you guys kind of have a algorithm for of sorts, in addition to, the fuel strategy, or is that something that, I could imagine also that there are a lot of situations where you just don't have enough data on a particular weekend going into the event to really know, and it's a more significant variable. So I'm curious how you guys think about that, given that it feels like it's become more of a factor.
I agree. It's definitely a big factor in the racing that we've had recently. And it's something that plays a lot into your strategy, because you have to not only plan your stints on which tire, but you have to plan, when do you want to be fast? Because your opportunities to pass people are kind of contingent on, what is your delta to the car in front of you need to be to actually get by them? Because you can be faster and not be able to get by. So, looking at your race from a holistic view, when are you going to be able to make passes? When are you going to be able to make hay? Yes, we look at tire fall off during the race, and I'll stop short of saying exactly how.
Fair enough.
But yes, we look at it very carefully, and we do study it, and it is very difficult. It's challenging when you come back to a track, if the track surface has changed, or if the ambient conditions are different, if the tire Even if you're coming back with the same tire, it was produced at a different time of year, it could be slightly different. There's a lot of different factors that influence that. So even if you're coming back to the same race a year later with theoretically the same tire, your falloff characteristics could be wildly different, and that really influences your race. And you have to be able to react during a race, if the result that you're getting is different from what you expected. So you need to know that pretty early on if you're seeing, a falloff curve that's different from what you thought you were going to get, and be able to make a decision how to basically salvage your race or have a contingency plan. We normally try and warm up to, run long enough to kind of know what the tires are going to do so that we can have a plan going to the race, based on, how long we think the tires are going to last. But it's always kind of a moving target, based on, what the ambient conditions are in the race and how hard you push. And sometimes you just get a set of tires that acts a little different than the others, and that's life. So you just kind of got to roll with it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
You've been working with Marcus like for the, for a period of time here. He strikes me as somebody who like you can rely on to be pretty like consistent over the course of a, of various stints, maybe like doesn't strike me as somebody who has a driving style, who's like really harsh on tires, equipment, these kinds of things. But I'm curious, we have certainly seen in some races and we have the benefit of looking at these things kind of like, after the fact that the, so with the benefit of hindsight, of some drivers just like, going ham at the beginning of a stint, and you're kind of watching it thinking like, do they know something that like we don't about what's going on here? Like
no.
when you're watching, you have kind of this more complete picture of like, that seems like this is gonna like backfire. So I guess I'm curious.
Just watching, licking my chops.
Yeah, right. Okay. So I'm curious from your perspective, maybe looking at it from not strictly from working with Marcus, but just more generally, like, do you feel how much can the engineer and the, and the timing stand help in that situation in terms of, maybe being a good, and that this all comes down to trust and the communication that you have with your driver and how much they're going to listen versus just kind of doing what they feel is right in the moment. And we're getting into the nitty gritty stuff of like what ends up meaning that you're winning races and instead of, finishing third or fourth or eighth or ninth sometimes. But I'm just curious, kind of what your perspective is from the timing stand in those kind of situations. Trying to relay that information, make sense of that data in a way that is going to have an impact on the driver to understand like a scope that maybe they don't see.
I would say in general, at Chip Ganassi Racing, all of our drivers are exceptional at having patience, saving tires, and knowing when it's time to push. I think there's some drivers in the field who maybe don't manage that as well, and maybe need some extra coaching on backing off a little bit. I'm kind of happy. It benefits us to see that. There's a driver attitude, a driver trust point of view that you have to look at. And Marcus and I have spoken about it already many times. You have to have the mindset going to the race that, you're gonna maybe get stuck behind someone, and being, 3 inches behind, the rear wing for the entire stint is gonna do nothing but eat your front tires up. So either pass them or back off and save your tires, save some fuel. And it's on you on the timing stand to recognize that, because obviously we're in a lower pressure situation, sitting on the timing stand than sitting in the seat in the car, to remind them if that situation comes up, or watching the gaps on track, like, hey, either pass them or back off, hey, we'll let you know when it's time to push, or you know what, we're going to get them in the pit cycle. You just got to be patient. So it's a repetitive message that we're saying every race. They're hearing it often. Be patient. We'll tell you when it's time to push. And when it's push time, then it's time to use up your tires. And the other important part of that is having a plan going into the race. So if you know what your fuel window is, and you know about when you're expecting to pit, if you've got to make these tires last 30 laps, you have to start the stint knowing, hey, I'm going to make these last 30 laps. So, I can't be 15 laps into a stint and have my rear tires completely gone. When we get to 25 laps and you still got a little bit of margin left, then you can start pushing.
JR, we definitely asked a person from the wrong team that question, I think.
I know. No, I was thinking the same thing. I was like, I mean, like Dixon or, Ericsson, Polo. I mean, for God's sake,
Polo we've got like famously bad on his
the
tires.
top three of the top four.
Yeah, you see the gap charts, and you watch some of the cars start to tank, and that's when you really start to get the grin on your face. Like, that's, 20 laps in a stint is when we start eating people up. Like, okay, maybe we don't look like the fastest car for the first two or three laps, but 20 laps into a stint, we're going to get by you.
I'm curious as well, just lastly on tires, because I don't want to spend the whole hour talking to you about tires, because that'd be very boring for you. But the difference between drivers really interests me as well in the IndyCar context, because I guess if you're looking at something like Formula One, you've got two cars and they tend to develop in a certain direction, and then the drivers are responsible for driving the car in the fastest possible way, right? Like the kind of the car setup is in a way defined by the engineers and the people who develop the car. Whereas with IndyCar, you've got well, at least it feels like from the outside, you've got a bit more freedom to give the driver a little bit more of what they want. You can have different driving styles between cars, and you can kind of, tweak to suit each driver. But I guess when you're trying to analyze things like tire wear and stuff like that, it must be quite difficult sometimes when you've got a driver who's got a different driving style to the others, and trying to kind of like marry all of that together. Is that kind of solved by the fact that each team has an individual strategist and an individual engineer? So you're all responsible for your own car, and you kind of move forward in that way.
Man, it's kind of a loaded question, because the answer is kind of it depends. I've dealt with two drivers now who have come from the very European way of thinking. Marcus Ericsson came from F1, and Marcus Armstrong came up through Formula 3, Formula 2. And they both kind of had the mindset of, you give me the car and I just drive it, and what I say doesn't matter. And you really have to coach that out of them early on. They're not used to having to give feedback. So the feedback that Marcus Ericsson gave his first, year, you really had to pull out of him, like, hey, what is the car doing? Yeah, it's a little bit, it's a little bit understeery. Like, okay, where is it understeery? Low speed, high speed, middle of the corner. So you really have to pull the information out of them. Once you get the information, then you can work on the setup to suit them. And so when we send the cars out, the setups might not all be the same between four cars. We haven't, you know, collaborated and said like, this is the setup. This is theoretically the fastest car, because the way that Scott Dixon drives is very different from the way Alex Palou drives and is different from the way that Marcus Armstrong drives. So they all kind of need a bit something different. That all being said, there are certain things that you do that will eat the tires up. And so there is a bit of coaching going on as far as saving tires and driving styles. We have some metrics that we look at that will tell us, you know, you're using the tires more here and here. And we think that over a stint that, you know, you're going to get two less laps than, you know, say Alex is going to. So we do actively coach our drivers on where and how to save tires. So it's a bit of a give and take. You know, the setup obviously affects it, but there's also certain driving styles that, you know, don't help your situation.
Sure. I guess to change topics a little bit, I'm kind of interested in how you felt the kind of announcement of your, you know, your new role went. And I guess IndyCar claimed that you're the fourth female lead engineer on an IndyCar team, which I guess is a, you know, a nice thing to go in the history books for you. But at the same time, I guess you'd much rather that headline be like, you're the first Angela Ashmore to be a lead IndyCar engineer, right? So I guess I'm kind of interested in how you feel about the kind of women in motorsport narrative and how that kind of plays out for you, because of course you just want to be treated equally and you want to feel like you're, you know, an equal member of any team that you're on and that your success is treated the same as anybody else. But I guess there's people out there like JR who has a young daughter, and I guess you also feel an element of wanting to put yourself out there and be visible so that, you know, young women can see that your position is obtainable as a job and as a career in the future. So how do you balance that? And I guess, how do you feel about that whole narrative and how it works for you?
Honestly, you took the words right out of my mouth, because there's half of me that says, I just want to do my job and be successful and have my success treated in the same way as it is for everyone else. But there's another part of me that says, man, there's some young girls out there that really need to see a strong female being successful. And, you know, I was that young girl once who was watching TV, watching the races on Sunday, and the only women that I saw were the ones that were on the driver's arms. They were never in a technical position. They were never on a pit crew. They were never on a timing stand. And obviously it's come a long way since then, but it's obviously not quite progressed where it needs to yet. So I'm happy to be part of that success. It does put a little bit of extra pressure on, I think, because obviously I want to do a good job. And when you do well very publicly. And when you have a bad weekend, you have a bad weekend very publicly. And that's just part of what comes with the job. I'm obviously with a great team and a great position for success. I have all the tools that I need to do my job well. And I think that I've been well prepared. I have all the experience that I need. So I think that I'm well prepared to be successful this year. And I hope that I am. And it's a lot. I want to do a good job, and I want young women to see that success and feel like they're a part of it and feel encouraged. And so I think a lot of that pressure I put on myself. And also I'm just extremely competitive, like most other people are who do this job. I have a quote that I always look back on. You have to always believe that you'll be the best, but never believe that you have done so. And I think about that pretty often. Like, I do genuinely believe that I will be the best person that's ever done this job, but I'm not there yet. So that's what I'm always working towards. I want to be the best race engineer that's ever done this job. And I hope that down the line sometime I can be remembered that way, but we'll just get through the first season first.
It does feel like we've had like a decent period here where we've had things like Pareto Autosport happen and those guys getting to the Indy 500, and it does feel like there's more women visible in the paddock. I don't know if that's something you share, and do you feel like that's something that, you know, it's an atmosphere inside the IndyCar series as a whole at the moment that kind of is helping that to happen a little bit more, that it's a welcoming environment, and that you are able to move freely in these kind of positions and not worry about your gender or, you know, anything like that?
I think culturally, IndyCar is an excellent environment. From where I came from, I didn't necessarily feel that way. I never really felt like my gender had anything to do with, you know, where I was able to move within the paddock, which is a great thing. So I think IndyCar has moved pretty far along. There are some key players, and I always give a shout out to Kira Kristalik, because she's kind of the leader of the pack. She's been around for a while, and she made me feel so welcome when I came into IndyCar. And so I always have to remember to thank her for making me feel that way, because I didn't always feel that way. And it makes a big difference just to have somebody reach out and say, like, hey, I'm really glad you're here.
Kara is definitely someone I want to get on the pod at some point. She's a fantastic spokesperson for IndyCar as a whole generally. So we'll definitely have a look at getting her on the pod. Anyway, let's wrap up with Marcus Armstrong and how you kind of feel his season's going to go. He had a good rookie year last year. He's obviously come from F2, like you said. He knows how to baby a tyre after looking after Pirelli's in F2. And I know, speaking to him at the start of last season, he was amazed at how much of a role he felt he had in the team. I know a lot of teams use the kind of term like the driver is like the quarterback of the team, and I think Marcus is, as you were kind of talking about before, maybe not used to giving as much of his own opinion about things, or maybe deciding the direction of where a team goes or where the car setup goes, or his feedback and stuff like that. I know he was kind of surprised by how much kind of say he had in everything. Just seeing him develop from the outside over the course of last season, what are you kind of, I mean, I don't know if you're the kind of person who likes to set like number goals or things like that, but what are you kind of expecting to see from him, and what be, if we were talking at the end of next season, what would have been a successful year for Marcus, do you think?
I don't like to set number goals, but we do have two goals as a team, and number one is to win the Indianapolis 500, and obviously we have the cars that are capable of doing that. And number two is to win the championship. And so what I've spoken to Marcus about is just consistency through the season. I think that's the biggest thing for us. We need to qualify well. We need to be transferring into the second, third group and qualifying. When you qualify at the front, it makes your race a whole lot easier. And so that's one of the things that he struggled with last year. Obviously, he was very fast. He has the speed to get the job done, so that's not a worry for me. We just need to qualify well, and then that makes our racing a lot easier. And then being consistent among races. One of the things that we spoke about is, man, if you just finished eighth, which is not like really a particularly great finish, if we finished eighth at every race, like, where do you think that you'd finish in the championship if you finished eighth every race?
I know it was Alex Palou's worst finishing position, wasn't it, last year? So I guess like behind Alex Palou, but still quite well in the championship.
Yeah, certainly inside the top five, I would
Yeah,
think.
I would say so.
Top five for sure.
Yeah.
And I think if we finish inside the top five of the championship, that would be an excellent year for him. Obviously, we want to go out and win races. That's our goal. But being realistic about it, if we can be consistent, try and be, you know, top six or better in every race, those are realistic, great goals. And I think that's going to get us to the goal at the end of the season, which is to put ourselves in a position for a championship. So, you know, if you're shooting to hit an average of P6, that means, you know, if you're at the front of the race every weekend, you're eventually going to win one. You know, you're going to be on the podium, because, you know, some people are going to fall out. There's going to be attrition. Obviously things happen. You have mechanical failures every once in a while, so you're going to have a bad race here and there, but we're just aiming for consistency to qualify well, and I think that's going to get the job done.
Well, Angelo, thanks so much for talking to us. We really appreciate it. We're sorry we've bombarded you with questions about tires and stuff like that, but it's been great to talk to an IndyCar engineer. We don't get to do it as often as we would like to on the pod, so you can probably tell how excited JR and I to fire a load of engineering questions at you, and it's great to hear your thoughts on everything. So we wish you all the best of the season. I hope the kind of debut season goes well with Marcus, and I hope we can speak to you some point later in the season as well. It'd be great to have you back and chat about how things are going.
Yeah, hopefully you can talk to me as a race winner soon.
Sounds good. Thanks very much, Angela.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
So that was Angela Ashmore. Great to have her on the show. I genuinely mean it that we hope we can have her back later in the season. Some fascinating insights into Ganassi as a whole. JR, I don't know about you, but I just kind of felt like an immediate sense of like gravitas in the way that Angela kind of talks about everything to do with IndyCar generally, but just specifically some of the engineering questions. It felt like she was always maybe holding a little bit back in terms of like some little Ganassi secrets, but also just like the level of kind of insight we got there was really cool, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that she said that really resonated with me was just basically to that she feels calmer when she feels the most prepared. And I think that's something that, you know, whatever your line of work is, you sort of come to know that feeling, that when you're not quite prepared for something, or you don't feel like you have your bases covered, you're a little more anxious about whatever you're kind of taking on next. And, some of us gravitate towards roles or jobs where there's always a lot of unknown. So you just always kind of have to fight against that. But, at the same time, you kind of, learn over time that there's always a way to be a little more prepared for what you have coming up next. So, I think outside of just her skill and sort of experience and, I guess the predisposition that's required to be good at this job. You definitely come away from that interview thinking like, okay, I feel like she's kind of got this covered, So, I'm really excited to, and, obviously she's working with Marcus, in his first full-time season. So they'll have some growing pains just because of that, but, it'll be great to watch their progress over the year and like you said, hopefully be able to chat with both of them to kind of get a check-in on how things are going.
Yeah. I know just quickly before we go, I know you've always been a big supporter of, women in motorsport getting the opportunity when they've had the chance. And, Peretti, you've spoken at length about how cool you found all of that program. And now obviously being a dad to a little girl as well. I mean, it must feel like, Well, if we're having this conversation, it's not perfect in terms of the level of diversity in the series, but it does feel like IndyCar is a welcoming paddock, and to be able to have that feeling, I'm sure you'll want to take your daughter to the paddock one day when she's old enough to remember it. And there's a lot of women out there who could be doing roles in motorsport that aren't. So to have people like Angela around is, it's not nice that they sometimes have to go through extra scrutiny, or they have to have these conversations about being women in motorsport when actually they just want to talk about being competitors. But it does feel like there's a kind of bigger win in all of that they are, represented.
Yeah. I think when I think about it through the eyes of, a father to a daughter now, that whether it be, a female driver like a Simona or a Tatiana Calderon or whoever, or female engineer like Angela, I think what the little tweak on the lens that I have for it now is you want for those women in those positions to have the air about them that they're just there to fucking go do their thing, and that's what I want my daughter to see other women doing in whatever space it might be, whether it's motorsport or something else. But
yeah,
and so I feel like some of that is predicated on having some women in those roles that just have that disposition about them, that they're and Angela seems very much came across as one of those that she doesn't really care, like you can tell that she senses there's maybe this external view or pressure or whatever, that she may be judged in some way differently than the average male that's in one of those roles. But you know, I think a lot of progress happens when you just see that confidence kind of come from the inside. And so it will continue to take. We've seen this throughout sports history, whether it be, you know, the desegregation of Major League Baseball or, you know, whatever, that it takes some people doing an extremely good job in high pressure situations and having that confidence about them to kind of break down people's, you know, view of whether there's some difference between a, you know, male or female or, you know, of different race or whatever, doing different types of things. But, you know, my hope certainly is that that continues to happen, and that we could, it's part of our job as people within the sport to like empower those people just to be themselves and do their thing. Because I think the more that happens, the more it will be obvious that having more females on your team is actually just a competitive advantage. Right. So, yeah, it was great to chat with her. And, you know, certainly I think we look forward to seeing more young women in the paddock, you know, and starting to work towards these kinds of roles. I mean, like we heard from Angela, like this did not happen all of a sudden yesterday. Like there's, mm-hmm. you know, a decade long plus sort of trajectory that she's been on to get to this point. And so, you know, I think what we're also skipping over is that whole period of time of being really one of the only women in a role like this for a long time up to now. So, yeah, it's great. It's really cool to see her in that spot. Yeah, it's, you know, I think it'll just be the start of more to come.
Thanks for sharing that, JR. That's all for this episode of the Race IndyCar podcast. You can head to the-race.com for all of your IndyCar news, analysis, and features. I wrote one recently about Pato O'Ward's kind of hero versus idiot approach to his racing, which are his own words, and hopefully that's a good insight into his kind of approach. We've spoken about it on the pod a lot.
Glad you clarified that those are his words.
Yeah. So we've spoken about this a lot on the podcast over the past year, and like Pato's kind of reaction and how he interprets things, and like he's just a different approach to some other drivers, where he just like accepts that some of his risks are going to make him look like an idiot, and some of them are going to make him look like a hero. And the crux of the feature is that he's like willing to live with that because he believes that. He, you know, the upside is greater than the downside to his approach. So would definitely recommend going to read that and not just judging that feature based on that one little sentence that you just heard there. And thanks to Pato for making the time in a very, extremely busy off-season to chat about that. So that was good fun. Head to the race to see that. You can also go back and listen to some of our previous episodes. You can definitely go back and listen to the tech special that we did if you enjoyed listening to Angela talk about some of the more intricate technical aspects of IndyCar. We did a lot on dampers and aerodynamics as well, and comparing IndyCar engineering to Formula One as well. So you can go back and listen to those. We'll be back. Our next episode is with James Hinchcliffe, where we'll preview St. Petersburg, the first race of the IndyCar season, which we're both looking forward to. So that's all for this episode of the Race IndyCar podcast.
The Athletic.